everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and today we've got a very special Science Studio. They're all special, but we're going to be talking to a gentleman. His name is Bruce Bunting. He has got an incredibly complicated career pattern for me. He started out as a scientist, a veterinary medicine, went to work for the World Wildlife Fund, and then landed up working for the Bhutan Foundation. And that seems quite an exotic journey. So let's hear about it. Bruce, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's going to be great fun. So before we get on to either WWF or the Bhutan Foundation, why don't you tell us a little bit how on earth you did this transition when you were a young kid into what you are today?
Well, my father was a scientist, and I always admired him and aspired someday to be a scientist myself. And during the course of my studies, I was sitting down at the University of Miami in Florida as my junior year, wondering what I was going to do with my life. I thought I was going to be a marine biologist, but I didn't quite understand how that was all going to work. And in a conversation I had with my father, he said, "Well, you love animals. Why don't you study veterinary medicine?" And so the next thing you knew, I was up at Michigan State University and studying veterinary medicine, and graduated in 1972, and started practicing in California and later in Michigan and Massachusetts.
Were you a large animal veterinarian or a small animal veterinarian?
In California, I was a small animal veterinarian. In Michigan, I started in my practice was in equine medicine. But I always had a strong interest in international conservation. I actually sold my equine practice to another veterinarian and took the profits and flew off to Africa to stop the ivory trade and save the elephants. And that was in 1978. Unfortunately, the elephants are still suffering today, but we did get a bill passed in Congress banning the import of ivory into the United States, sponsored by Anthony Bielenson, who was a congressman from California. So it was somewhat successful. But that also got me interested in conservation. And a few years later, in 1984, I happened to be in the right place at the right time. And the World Wildlife Fund hired me to go to Nepal and start a WWF program in that country, having never been to Asia before in my life.
And did you know much about world wildlife? apart from elephants and ivory?
Well, they're a global organization. They operate in, oh my gosh, it's probably close to 100 countries. And I always admired them. I'd always been a member. And I just was very fortunate that they gave me that opportunity. And I actually never looked back and ended up moving from Michigan and selling my practice and living in Washington, D.C. for the last 31 years.
Tell us a little bit about what the World Wildlife Fund does. I mean, how does that sort of operate?
Well, they're focused on their bottom line is endangered species. But they get at it in all sorts of different ways. They're very creative and innovative, and they look at things like global consumption as a threat to ultimately to wildlife and fishery stocks and all those things. And so they have a very holistic approach. And they also are very good at building local capacity. So while you have WWFs in all the European countries and in the United States, you also have WWFs in the Philippines, Nepal, Bhutan. And so they're local organizations as well, but part of this international network. So because of that, they're very effective.
So the actual headquarters then is in D.C., and they spread out and give expertise to these secondary organizations?
Yes, the actual headquarters is in Switzerland.
Oh, okay.
And but there are five or six of the WWF organizations that are quite large and very good at raising money. The WWF US is one, WWF UK, WWF Netherlands, WWF Switzerland.
Okay, I got the idea. Yeah. So this is really a worldwide operation.
Yes.
And each country has its own targets, for example. I mean, let's assume that we're dealing with WWF in the United Kingdom. Do they have special target areas, special aspects of wildlife or forestry? I mean, how does that work? Do you all make separate goals?
No. Actually, as a global organization, there are global goals, and the entire network aspires to meet those goals. It's a, quite a process. And the, so WWF UK, although it does do things in the UK, would be far more active in China or the Philippines or other countries in supporting activities. But they, but they support it as a global network. It's more of a transfer of resources internationally. So WWF US, while it does have an active engagement in the United States, I would guess that some 70-80% of its funding actually goes overseas to save everything from the giant panda, tigers, snow leopards, you name it.
Okay, now that brings up a couple of interesting points. Quite often, we in the West think we see problems where people in the areas where we perceive the problem to be may have a different attitude. I mean, so you've got to be quite delicate, I would imagine, on how you go into a different neighborhood or a different country and simply say, look, we're here to help the ivory trade go bankrupt, where there must be a lot of people over there that think the ivory trade is good for their local environment and their good business. How do you handle that sometimes?
Well, it can be very tricky, and you're right. And something like the ivory trade is also complicated by the incredible amount of corruption that can take place. And key to the ivory trade is really getting China to take responsibility. And I think to some extent they're beginning to do that. They are the main driving force behind the ivory trade. But they, you know, the world, I just hope they wake up fast enough, but they are waking up. And if you take a country like China, they've done an amazing job over the last 20-some years saving the giant panda, which was on the brink of extinction, and the population has more than doubled since then.
Because, no, I could see that become a very, you know, I mean, it's almost like an icon for China.
Yes,
but
yes.
Ivory tried. I mean, what do they, what's their main use for ivory apart from decorative? Do they use it in some potent medication?
No, no, it's decorative mostly. And there is some use of rhino horn in medications,
right.
But
yeah,
it's mostly
one.
The ivory goes into status symbols, you know.
Yeah. Tell me, you know, when you were there, how long did you work for the WWF?
25 years.
Can you look back on it and say, in all honesty to the audience, myself, yourself, in fact, more importantly, oh boy, I really think I made a difference, and here is where I can say the difference was.
I do feel very strongly that I made a difference, and some of the things I worked on, one of the most creative was coming up with ways to finance conservation. WWF actually set up a center for conservation finance, and the initial thing we did, there, you'll recall in the late 1980s, there was a global debt crisis, and a very creative former vice chairman of J.P. Morgan suggested a great idea on how to raise money for conservation. The banks at the time were doing something called debt equity swaps, and he said, "You, Bruce, you could do the same thing for conservation." And we coined the expression debt for nature and transacted literally hundreds of millions of dollars. That to even today, there's a foundation in the Philippines working on environmental and conservation issues that was started right around the late 80s. And it's still thriving today. And that was all done through a debt swap.
I'm a scientist. I read a lot, but I've got no real clue on what debt for nature actually means and how does it work.
Well, I'm going to be real simple because they can get very complicated. But what we initially would do is we would find a donor. Let me give the Philippines as an example. We found a donor in terms of USAID, and they gave us money. We then negotiated with the central bank to buy debt that the central bank owed to external parties. And we bought that debt for 40 cents on the dollar. And so I think it was $15 million that USAID gave us became something like $35, $40 million in central bank bonds in the Philippines. Now, the Filipinos had to pay back their debt in U.S. dollars, but we could accept the Philippine peso. So it was a win-win for both sides. We got pesos that we could spend, WWF could spend in the Philippines, and basically those bonds endowed a foundation that continues to this day.
So, and that foundation used the money to do what exactly?
All sorts of things. It wasn't to buy land. That's very difficult to do in developing countries, unlike what somebody might, like the Nature Conservancy does very effectively in the United States. But it was more for conservation efforts, training, equipment, anti-poaching definitely, but most of the anti-poaching in the Philippines was marine-based. They would dynamite coral reefs to fish and very destructive practices.
Good Lord.
And so it went into that. That's where the funds were used.
And so that's quite exciting. And presumably in the middle of all this, Bruce is thinking every now and again, gosh, and I used to be a small and large animal veterinarian. And how did this all come about?
Well, you know, it's interesting because first of all, I had a love for animals and I had a love for science. And those two came together very nicely in veterinary medicine. And I think when I was hired by World Wildlife Fund, they thought, what better than a guy who's a veterinarian to go out and save endangered species?
That's absolutely right.
So,
one final question before we move away from WWF and Bruce's participation. Listening to you talk, it seems to me that you made allusion to, if not directly, to the fact that things like population control, climate change, these would be important issues for the WWF. And you must have, or had, when you were there, positions on these topics.
We did. And I think one of the innovative things about WWF is being able and willing to accept reality. And the climate is changing. And so WWF began to look at the world and think of ways where you could mitigate climate change. For example, as species that would normally exist in low elevations, warmer climates, as climate change takes place, are they able to migrate to slightly higher elevations to maintain the habitat that they need to survive? So WWF looked at national parks around the world and found ways that those animals might be able to migrate upwards, sort of almost animal highways connecting national parks and reserves. So that's just one example, but they're doing many, many things on climate change.
One final question before we leave this topic and get on to Bhutan. Tell me a little bit about prospects for the young student that's out there listening and saying, my goodness, that seems to me something I'd like to become involved with, either as a part-time interest or even as careers. Are those possibilities there? And there must be a website somewhere.
Well, I think there are incredible opportunities and careers. WWF actually has a program called Education for Nature, in which this is mostly scholarships for students from developing countries, but they've built quite a cadre around the world of young people wanting to go to college and study in various environmental sciences and go on and have careers in conservation.
But back in their own country.
That's
the key important feature.
Absolutely, back in their own country. And
okay.
it has been quite a successful program. It's actually named after a man named Russell Train, who was one of the founders of WWF, a great man, second administrator of the EPA, father of the Endangered Species Act under Richard Nixon, did a lot of great things.
Okay. Well, I think we've got to finish this first part of the program. Everyone, you're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with Bruce Bunting, who was vice president for the WWF, the World Wildlife Fund. And we'll be back in one moment to talk about his activities with Bhutan and the Bhutan Foundation.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Niesel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Occasionally, as scientists, we get news that makes us celebrate. Here's one we thought was pretty cool. Surveys show most Americans strongly support public and private investments in biomedical and medical research.
How many? 90% of Americans favor funding by the government for biomedical research, which focuses on advancing health.
There is fundamental biological research where its impact is typically not seen for years, but can have huge payoff. Clinical research, though, involves people directly and can quickly lead to new therapies.
Both types are interrelated and important. Fundamental research provides insight into diseases so that treatments can be developed.
Overall, 88% of Americans encourage partnerships between universities, government agencies, and industry. 65% of people said they wanted President Trump to make biomedical research a priority in his first 100 days.
78% feel this should be a priority for the new Congress, but the government may not agree. Funding for the National Institutes of Health has fallen by 20% since 2003.
Yet investment in biomedical research has paid off. Average life expectancy in the U.S. has risen by a little over 8 years to 78.7 years. Deaths from leading causes are down, including cancer, stroke, diabetes, and even heart disease.
Federal investment in research has resulted in $60 billion of new economic activity, which led to over 350,000 jobs in 2015. Health research pays off all around, leading to better health and a stronger economy.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Bruce Bunting. And Bruce, you're still there, so why don't you put on your other hat and tell us, you know, how being involved in WWF translated into an interest in Bhutan and your current position associated with the Bhutan Foundation?
Well, it's interesting. Back in the mid-80s, when I started working with World Wildlife Fund, even then, Bhutan was known as sort of this mystical, pristine type country and very much closed to outsiders. But I finally convinced them that they should at least talk to me and to World Wildlife Fund about a possible program there. And so I was invited in 1986 to go to Bhutan. And it's interesting now that we're talking with an emphasis on science, because my first trip, I had the good fortune of having an audience with Bhutan's king. And he welcomed the World Wildlife Fund, but he had one condition. He said, you know, Bhutan has never been really researched. There hasn't been a lot of scientific research that's taken place in our country. And there's lots of things that we need to discover. And we want to make those discoveries. But we want those discoveries made by Bhutanese scientists. And I said, great, that sounds perfect. And the king said, well, Bruce, we only have one problem. We don't have any Bhutanese scientists. And so the World Wildlife Fund spent the next decade building a cadre of Bhutanese scientists. Today, over 30 Bhutanese have graduated from the Yale School of Forestry with their master's degrees. They're all back in Bhutan. And I also want to add, since I'm sitting in El Paso at the University of Texas, El Paso, over 36 Bhutanese have graduated from UTEP. And there's 33 Bhutanese currently on campus studying in a variety of fields, including science.
Right. So, and just for the listeners that are a long way from knowing about UT El Paso, one of the reasons is because we have this incredibly beautiful Bhutanese architecture that's becoming quite well known around the world. You've got in the studio with you two people, Sering and Tachi. Perhaps you could introduce them and tell us a little bit about the foundation.
Tachi Dukpa lives in Thimphu and is the director of the Bhutan Foundation in Thimphu. Tachi, you want to say hi?
Hello. It's good to be on your show. Thank you.
And then, it's a pleasure to have you, sir.
And then we have Ms. Sering Yangzim, who is also with the Bhutan Foundation. She's director of programs and external relations. She's based in Washington, D.C. Sering?
Hi. Thank you for having me today. And we're very excited to be at UTEP.
Oh, I'm glad you are. I wish I happened to be there with you this week, but I couldn't be. So who wants to start out with just describing what is the Bhutan Foundation?
Yes, Sering will give you an overview.
The Bhutan Foundation is actually a really small non-for-profit organization, and we are based in Washington, D.C., but we also have an office in Thimphu, which implements most of our programs. And we're the only organization based wholly on supporting Bhutan and building capacity in Bhutan. And we support a lot of the programs based on the four pillars of gross national happiness, which is the development philosophy of Bhutan. And the four pillars are based on environmental conservation. And then we also have programs under cultural preservation. So we are also helping restore old heritage sites, monasteries, and old palaces in Bhutan, as well as conserving some of our rich traditions and songs and music and dance.
So it's a multicultural. I mean, it's just not science and wildlife conservation, but
exactly.
The whole nature of the society itself.
Right. And that brings me to the third pillar, which is the equitable and sustainable development. So this is one area where we have a major of our projects, and that includes supporting emergency medical services in Bhutan, as well as public health. And we are also working with the Ministry of Education in developing educational services for children with disabilities. So we have a wide variety of projects that we work in. And then the last pillar is actually good governance. But our focus in good governance is primarily supporting local civil society organizations, which are the local NGOs in Bhutan. And so we really focus on trying to help build their capacity in promoting their mission and so that they're able to implement their projects.
It's interesting you bring up the civil society, because I think you have to be blind these days not to know that Bhutan has undergone quite some political turmoil over the last decade or two. I mean, it is a kingdom, mm-hmm. but it's also there are people there that, just as in Great Britain, don't particularly think that having a kingdom, so to speak, with a royal family is the best way to go. How do you get around those sorts of issues?
Actually, it's kind of the opposite in Bhutan. We've actually had the good fortune of having such great leadership within our royal family that the Bhutanese people actually did not want a democracy, and our king actually handed democracy to us and said, hey, you can't put the entire power of a nation in the hands of any one person. You never know what kind of kings you might have in the future, but I want to make sure that I hand the power of the government to the people. So he actually commanded that Bhutanese people will have a democracy. And it wasn't just like all of a sudden he said, okay, here's democracy. It was actually a very thought-out process that he put together. And it started from a very long time ago, where he put together a committee of strong leaders within Bhutan itself and slowly kind of decentralized the government. And then also, you know, he looked at constitutions throughout the world. He had a committee together to put together the constitution for Bhutan. And once the committee decided, okay, this is what the constitution is going to be, and they put it out to the public to comment on it and see if anyone in the public, in the Bhutanese public, had any more comments. So it was actually a very thought-out process. And then he decided to step down as king and wanted to make his son the first king under a democratic constitutional monarch.
So that happened?
And yes. That happened, yes,
okay.
Very
so
much.
So how old is the new king?
Our new king is about 33, I think, or 35.
Okay, and was he educated outside of Bhutan and has been around the world? Or?
Yes, very much. Actually, our entire royal family has been very well educated throughout the world. In particular, our king got educated in Wheaton College in Boston. And then now he even completed his master's at Oxford University in the UK.
Is there an opposition to this?
If I may comment on that.
Please.
Democracy in Bhutan is into its eighth year. We are going to have the third general elections next year. And the transition from the monarchy into the democracy has been a very peaceful transition. as Tsering pointed out, that it has been very thought out and also very planned decentralization, as well as also bringing in the democracy, has been very much in a systematic and a planned way. And then that has not resulted in any revolts or turmoil in the country. Rather, it was a very peaceful transition, very unknown to the world in this time. And then we had our first elections in 2008. Right after that, we had the first parliament sitting and endorsing and signing the constitution of the country along with the current king. And then we had the second elections in 2013. So all the democratic institutions are in place.
Are there parties? Are there two parties or one or three or 20?
It started off with two major parties. Then in the second election, we had four parties. And now for the third elections, we are looking for around six parties to compete.
This is great, though. I mean, it's really an interesting insight to a society that is so hidden from most of the world. And of course, that brings up the point about where you are in the world. You're right up there in the ceiling next to Tibet, China, and India. Are all the borders secure?
Let me just quickly clarify one thing on the parties. I know where you were going with that. Someday we'll have 20 parties. Well, the way the Bhutanese operate this was very clever. They have a primary, and all the parties put up people for election, but only the top two parties go on to compete at the national level. So in the end, you only end up with two parties. It's a very clever way to have a multi-party system, but only two finish at the national level.
Okay. And we'll come to that another day, I'm sure. Look,
sure.
Well, Bruce, Tsering, Tachi, we've just got a couple of minutes left. Why don't I simply give you the floor to say something or tell the audience things that you don't think we've touched upon yet?
Well, I'd like to point out a couple of things about Bhutan. Since this is a science-based radio program, I think the conservation aspect of Bhutan is probably the most important. And I want you to imagine a country that has over 70% of its land still forested. It has a large, viable population of tigers. Tigers actually are at capacity in Bhutan, and they leave to go live in India and China. Snow leopards, same story. 100% a conservation success story. It is a country that has just decided to develop in a different way. Even its constitution mandates for all time that Bhutan will have over 60% of its land under forest cover, and they already exceed that. 50% of Bhutan is set aside as nature reserves, national parks and reserves. It's just a model for the world to look at, a successful model on how to develop economically in a different way. And it's based all on this concept, this vision that the king came up with in the 1970s when he first started his reign of, instead of producing gross domestic product, he suggested Bhutan pursue gross national happiness.
Yeah, I mean, that went around the world as a sort of a wonderful concept. Let me just interject. The forests, are they a source of food product too? Is there hunting and people live off the forest too?
No. Well, Bhutan is predominantly a Buddhist country, and so hunting is not something that they advocate. The forest, I'd say the biggest contribution of the forest is it makes Bhutan, in terms of climate change, not only carbon neutral, but a net carbon negative. They give back to the world more as a carbon sink than they take themselves. So it's really the forest provides a global asset.
One final point that I suppose is worth bearing in mind. I've done some homework once or twice on Bhutan because of the nature of Utah Paso. It's the least populated almost place in the world. What's the population?
The population is around 790,000 people.
That's about the size of El Paso, Texas.
Exactly. In fact, a good example when you want to compare Bhutan with Texas. So Bhutan is 15 times bigger than El Paso County, but about the same population.
Yeah, that puts it in perspective. And Sering, I thank you very much for participating today. Tachi, I also thank you very much. I wish I could have met you both. And Bruce, thank you very much. And I suspect that my next trip to Washington, I'm going to come in and meet you all up there and maybe do another program.
That would be great. We'd love that.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I'd like to thank Lauren Tarasis for putting this program together. I'd like
to thank
the audience for listening. And we'll be back next week with yet another Riveting Science Studio. Take care. Mm-hmm.